Hello and welcome to Conker's Corner. Today I have the privilege of speaking with Lee Robertson. Lee Robertson is the Chief Executive and Founder of Investment Quorum. Now, let me just give you a little bit about Investment Quorum. It's a deliberately sized boutique wealth management firm that delivers high-quality financial planning and investment solutions to private clients, trusts and charities. Good morning to you, Lee. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well, thank you.
Now, Lee, Investment Quorum is an award-winning wealth management firm. I should have added in the intro there. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
As you know, I like to start off the Conker's Corner interviews just to give people a little feel about who Lee Robertson is, where he started, where he did his education, etc. And then we're going to go into the other sections of the interview. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, so where did it all start for you, Lee, and where were you brought up?
I was brought up in Scotland, in Angus, a small town called Brechin, which is, I guess, somewhere between halfway between Dundee and Aberdeen on the northeast side of Scotland.
And your education, Lee, what did you do?
Oh, I did my schooling at Brechin High School, which was... a comprehensive, but one of those rollovers from the Scottish high schools that sort of, I guess you call them grammars down here. So written English was a big thing up there, which makes me a bit of a grammar demon here in the firm. I didn't do university. I went straight into the Royal Navy, but I did get my degree later on through Edinburgh Napier on distance learning. In fact, did that a couple of years ago.
Okay, so what was your thoughts then when you were younger in the sense of the Navy? What was the attraction there? And was there any influence on you to be going there? Any family or anything like that?
No, I think, in fact, family-wise, because Angus and Fife are Black Watch country. So many of my sort of uncles and cousins and things did time in a Black Watch in the army. But
yeah.
I always had this thing about going towards the RAF and I'd been an air cadet and that kind of stuff. And then just... you know, the way life goes, sometimes the plan doesn't work. And I ended up joining the Royal Navy and did 9 years there and absolutely adored it. But sooner or later, you've got to grow up and go and get a real job, I guess.
Yes, we've all been there. My time in the RAF as such. Now, so you did 9 years in the Navy.
I did.
What section were you involved in there?
Originally communications. That was my base trade. And I'm old enough that we still had to learn Morse code back then. And then latterly, I worked more in the intelligence side, which was a natural progression for lots of communicators because of the high security classifications that we got for doing our ordinary day jobs.
Excellent, excellent. So you did your 9 years. You travelled around the world a little bit, I take it?
Yeah, you never get quite as far as you think you're going to get to. I mean, I think I joined up thinking I wanted to be on fast patrol boats in Hong Kong. And I think about, doesn't everyone? And I think a month after I joined, they decommissioned them because two of them crashed into each other.
Oh, bless.
It happens more than you think. And then I never made Hong Kong, although I was there recently on business. But it's that usual thing, Europe, Middle East, Africa. I did the States for a long trip, which was very, very good. But I never did the Far East in the Navy. But hey, you know, you take what you're given in the forces, as you very well know.
Yes, you do. You go to the recruitment agency and they say, yeah, you'll see the world, young man. You know, make a man of you. It does make a man of you. And I completely agree with that. I enjoyed my time there. But you don't get to see quite the whole of the world, do you?
No, you see some of the bits you don't want to see, of course, but we'll probably leave that there. Yeah,
leave that there, definitely. So after that, having got your qualifications, experience in doing the intelligence sort of field, what was the attraction then to investing, and why did you take that leap of faith?
Oh, listen, I always admit it was a complete accident. As coming out, I thought I was joining the civil service. There was a bit of a time delay on that. At the time, I was sorting out my first mortgage, and I knew nothing about it. But the guy doing it, the mortgage broker, was a complete buffoon, it turned out.
Oh.
So I ended up stepping in and sorting it out myself.
Brilliant.
And his manager offered me a job. And I thought, well...
what, his job?
Well, it wasn't his job, but he didn't stay long. But and I thought, well, you know, this is okay. I can do this until the civil service get their act together.
Yeah.
And then I just, so by pure accident, as a stopgap job, I ended up staying in and just really enjoyed it. And of course, when I did it, it was the early 90s. It was Thatcher years.
Yeah.
it was a very buoyant time. And I know she's quite a divisive character now, but or she was even then, I guess. But there was a real optimism. There was lots of financial freedoms coming along. There was pensions and SERPs and mortgages, and it was a real boom time. So it was quite an exciting thing to get into, and I guess I was seduced in that way.
Excellent. So where was your first start then? Which company were you first with?
Oh, Allied Dunbar.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've gone through many iterations. It was a company of its time.
They did fantastic
training, although mainly sales training rather than technical and product training, if I'm honest, looking back.
Yeah.
But it was a company of its time. It taught you to be fearless, never to be frightened to pick up the phone, never to be frightened to sit in front of a potential new client. So I only did a year there. I mean, as I say, it was round about that time. It was quite management heavy.
Yeah.
And everyone seemed to take a slice of what you did, which didn't leave much for you, despite doing all the work.
Of course.
The managers would all come back from the wine bar in the middle of the afternoon and shout at you, and you do it all again tomorrow.
Yeah.
But it was a good grounding. Then I moved through to the Halifax Group, where I met my business partner, Petronella, way back then, and my client liaison director, Paul, who's still with me today. We worked together in the Halifax Group on the mortgage side back then, did that for a couple of years, and then decided that financial planning and investment was more what I wanted to do, and I did 5 years with the Royal Bank of Scotland before eventually going independent.
Okie dokie. So when you went independent, you moved across to Capellette Financial Management for a while?
I did, yeah. That was my first firm with the guy who'd been my manager at Royal Bank of Scotland.
Yeah.
Although the internal joke was I was sort of his manager. He was a bit of an enfant terrible.
Yeah.
But incredibly bright. That lasted about 5 years. It was an independent advice firm of its day, as I say.
Yeah.
Many of my clients from then followed me through to this one. I think like lots of young marriages, my first business partner and I, we decided our paths didn't lie together after five years. So I started Investment Quorum. Petronella was working for me at Capulet, and I invited her to join me here when I decided to set this up, and she came through. So we started this in 2000. As I say, lots of my clients from Capulet just came over because it was very related. You know what independence is, it's very relationship-based.
Yeah.
So I've had clients for 20-odd years now, which is hopefully we're doing something right for them.
Excellent. So that was around October 2000, yeah?
Yeah, 1st of October 2000, so we're about 16 and a half years old now. And interesting, we're heading towards a third of a billion of client assets under management, and we've got many of our clients from the earliest days. So.
That's brilliant. Now, what I wanted to just touch on there regarding to Investment Quorum, I asked this question to Petronella as well, was the ethos. I mean, you've won several awards, and you've won some awards independently yourself, Lee. Now, what's the ethos then? Is that part of what you and Petronella are about, or is that Lee Robertson's ethos going from being in the Navy? What is it?
Well, I think when you found a firm, you hopefully found it in your own image. So you bring your own values, your own moral compass to things. And I learned a lot in my first business at Capulet. And you learn as many things about what not to do as what to actually do. So I hope that I've brought to Investment Quorum all that experience. And the ethos here is it's an interesting question. It's everyone will say this, but it's absolutely client first. We're a financial planning led business, despite being having discretionary investment permissions. It's client first. I mean, we still to this day continue to receive referrals from existing clients. Many have been with us many years, and it's whilst we always have to do a professional job, and I always drum into the team that we work for them. Over the years, you become very trusted, and you end up going to the weddings, the funerals, the bar mitzvahs.
Yes.
You know, you just do. It's slightly pastoral at times. It's slightly social at times. You know, you have clients crying on the phone because they're getting divorced. You have the privilege of being one of the first people to know some tragic news sometimes. And I think that probably denotes our ethos. Everyone knows. When clients ring in, the team all know who's calling, and it's a wonderful way to run a business. And I think that's why I like to be deliberately sized. When you get too big, it becomes a little bit impersonal, and you have other issues like shareholders and perhaps private equity backers and all that kind of stuff that impact on the way you deliver what you hope is really good, comprehensive wealth management advice.
Well, it's clearly working, Lee, because you're absolutely doing a stellar job. And I see quite often that you're out and
Thank
about
you.
doing speeches here, there, and everywhere, and people wanting you to deliver a presentation regarding the ethos of banking and investing, etc.
Yeah, I mean, it's a privilege to be asked, isn't it? That people feel you have something that you can share. I'm not a natural public speaker, and I decided to do it several years ago to sort of challenge myself. But it's lovely to be able to share best practice, knowledge, what not to do, what to do with people. And we particularly like young advisors coming through or first-time investors coming through, and we try and help them as best as we can.
Excellent. Now, of note here, I've seen that you were named the Spears High Net Worth Wealth Manager of the Year in 2016, and also winning the UK Wealth Management CEO of the Year in the International Le Fonte Business Awards 2017.
Yeah,
staggering. Listen, really good.
Thank you. Listen, you've got to take these things with a slight pinch of salt. You know, it's incredibly humbling to be judged that way by your peers.
Yes.
And both of those judging panels are pretty heavyweight. Yeah. So it is nice, but one always has to keep one's feet on the ground. And sometimes I think you might just be in the right place at the right time. But it is humbling, and it's a reflection, I think, on the whole team. It's not a personal award. I mean, Petronella's picked up awards through
as
the years
well,
too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's I think what's nice is we've picked up awards for the standards of our financial planning, for our investment management, for our client communications, and our client care. So that's across the piece. So I think we like to benchmark that way, but you know, we're not glory seekers, but it is humbling. But you got to keep your feet on the ground.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, with regarding your background, you know, a young man from Angus going into the Navy, not have no interest in investing, and then you know, you're having these awards, and then, you know, you become a freeman of the City of London.
Yeah, I did. Several years ago, a very, very good friend of mine who was very involved in what's termed the civic city,
yeah,
asked me to come along to a dinner at one of the worshipful companies. And I don't know, you're ex-RAF and I'm ex-Navy. Perhaps there's something in us that we like a bit of pomp and circumstance. We like a bit of dressing up.
Yeah.
And we don't mind the odd bugle fanfare.
We don't,
so
yeah,
maybe that's what attracted it to me. But of course, one's always looking to interact with clients, potential clients,
yes,
to meet people of interest who can help you or you can help them, and to be part of the fabric of the City of London, which is absolutely what the livery movement is, the civic city.
Indeed.
is fantastic. And if you know, freeman of the City of London, it's a nice thing to have gone through the same thing, that exactly the same ceremony that people at Lord Nelson did. You know,
yeah,
it appeals to the flummery of an ex-serviceman, I guess.
Yes, it does. A fantastic achievement, so congratulations on that, Lee.
Thank you. Now,
what I wanted to touch on, Lee, in this segment is just to talk about the investing and trading side of that. Now, I may make the wrong assumption and think, you know, the far large chunk of your wealth is wrapped up and invested into Investment Quorum. But I wanted to just touch on your investing aside from that, whether or not there's any legacy shares that you've held from your previous employers, or there's any shares that you actually buy in your personal and separated accounts.
Yeah, there are. I mean, We build portfolios here comprised of funds, investment trusts, and exchange-traded funds. So a large part of the way I invest is through collectives, I guess.
Yeah.
But one likes to have a kind of personal trading account for a bit of fun along the way. So, yes, I do have some shares, some of which I've held for a very long time.
Excellent. So with regards to the shares that you do hold, What would they qualify as? Would they qualify as FTSE blue chips, FTSE 350, anything below that?
Yeah, listen, I'm a very international investor, and yeah, I learn a lot from our investment officer here, Peter Lohman, who's a real city veteran.
Yeah,
I tend to be quite at the adventurous end. I tend to be very international, and I tend to be at the higher end. So, I mean, the things I'm holding at the moment would be things, you know, depending on where we're at. But
yeah,
you know, I like technology at the moment. I like Intel. I like Microsoft. I like Apple.
Yeah.
I tend to be at the blue chip end because I like dividends. Yes. I like to see visible earnings. You know, there are things you can do down at the smaller end, but I tend to stay at the higher end for this kind of stuff.
Okie dokie. So regarding those investments, you've mentioned some tech there and some blue chips, and you like your dividends, yeah?
Yeah.
Is there, if you can recall, the first stock that you bought, Lee, when you were like, I've got some money in my pocket, I've got a little bit of chunk of change after leaving the Navy, I'm making my first investment now. What, do you remember what that was?
Yeah, absolutely. It was British Gas. It was the whole, do you remember Ask Sid?
Oh, of course,
The TV ads. So yes. I think I talked earlier about the Thatcher years. I guess it was all part of that.
Yes.
Believe in it or not, it was that shared democracy that was going on, selling off the family silver, depending which side of the which side of the fence you particularly sit. But yeah, my first shares were British Gas, and I took up an allocation. I remember my mother and my stepfather and I buying them, and I held them. I'm still holding them in their current guise.
Excellent. So lots of chunky dividends for you there, and the splits, etc.
Yeah.
Cool. Now one of the questions I've got to ask there, Lee, is that obviously you're in the wealth management business and you're working with other clients. You've said you're adventurous in your own accounts. So are you a cautious long-term investor also?
I am. And I think people tend to, or certainly we do here, and I do in my own mind, you categorize different pots of money for different purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So retirement, the retirement pot, the thing that will eventually give you income, I tended to be much more adventurous because I had a very, very long time horizon. And of course, the old norms of people retire at 60 or 65 are disappearing rapidly.
Long gone, yeah.
Yeah. So actually, your investment horizon isn't till 65 anymore. It's probably to 85. So you can still be quite adventurous. And you actually need to be, probably. With my own stuff, I can be adventurous. But with my ISAs and all these other bits and pieces, I tend to be fairly middle of the road. All I'm looking for is a real return, which is beating inflation plus a bit to build wealth over the years. So, okay. Different strokes for different folks, I guess, but the different pots are treated differently.
Absolutely. So you mentioned technology. Is there a sector of a preference for you, Lee, at all?
Is there a what, sorry?
Is there a sector preference that you have regarding, you know, if you looked at your overall portfolio, what would have the largest weighting, do you think?
Currently, if we're just talking about my shares, it would definitely be tech.
Okay.
I've also got commodities in there because I think that's a recovery play. I have a feeling that both inflation and interest rates will be on the rise. So commodities, I think, is a decent play there. And I'm typically always carrying some healthcare and biotech. It's just because people always get sick and always will do.
Yeah.
So there will always be a demand for that kind of product, which sounds slightly cynical, but of course we're always looking for opportunities. So those would be my three big holdings at the moment in terms of asset allocation, but tech would be the biggest of them. I think this is a fantastically exciting time for tech.
Absolutely.
And whilst I'm holding the big players at the moment, you can just see some of the stuff coming through, and I think it's really exciting what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You think what Elon Musk is doing with Tesla, with batteries, with SpaceX. What I didn't realize is SpaceX now takes more stuff into space than NASA does, which I found out the other day.
So it's
an incredibly interesting time where tech oligarchs, if that's the right word, can actually shape the future of the whole planet. It's quite staggering. And he's gone on record to say that he may not be alive to see it, but he wants to see manned missions to Mars, and that's why he's developed SpaceX.
Absolutely. I mean, the way technology is encapsulated in so many different sectors, you know, healthcare, biotech, biopharma, the technology there is quite scary sometimes. You're thinking, you know, people are having concerns now about the robotics and AI, you know, and are they going to take jobs and will they, you know, take over the world sort of thing if we don't control them sort of thing. So
And quite big players are talking that way, and of course you've now got these experiments, particularly up in Scandinavia, where they're talking about giving living wages to citizens in certain towns, because they seem to have worked out that if technology does take away the jobs, what are people going to do? They still need to live and to be able to function and stuff. So it's an interesting time. It'll be interesting how it all plays out in the end, but I think Tech's got real legs.
I completely agree. Now, so regarding that criteria that you use, Lee, you know, you're researching these different companies, the tech companies and biotech companies that you like.
Yeah.
What's the essential criteria when you've done all your filtering, you've done all your research, you've checked out the CEO, the CFO, and etc., that says to you, Lee, in your personal account, I'm buying this today?
Yeah, I mean, it's good research, the strength of the balance sheet, cash flow. I like dividends. I particularly like rising dividends. I like a good track record of growth if possible and managing costs, which comes back to that due diligence on the management, as you say. I tend to avoid acquisitive companies. I prefer acquirees as opposed to acquirers in many ways, because I think the acquirer often ends up paying the cost, bearing the cost of doing the purchase.
Yeah.
But that's my general distillation of getting to buying a share.
Okay. So given the fact that you've been in the markets essentially since you were at Allied Dunbar in the 90s.
Yep.
Yeah. So good few years of seeing and being around the investment industry. And you know, your first share was British Gas. What's been the greatest lesson you've attained since you've been investing for yourself, Lee?
Stay in the markets. I think if get in and stay in. It's very difficult to time markets, and even the best people don't get it right that often. So I think what you've got to do is put your money in and stick to your plan. If your investment horizon is 15, 20, 25 years, you shouldn't be reacting to macro events. And I always use the example with clients of back in 2008, when the world virtually seized up financially.
Yes.
We all now know just how close it came to ATMs worldwide not dispensing cash and all the problems that would have led to.
Indeed.
But a year and a half later, the recovery was so strong that people had come out, you know, really decimated potentially their wealth. So I think that teaches. We saw again to a lesser extent in 2011. So I think get in and stay in. If you don't need the money and you've committed to the markets, leave it in there.
Excellent. I really appreciate the reply. Thank you for that.
Okay.
On the same sort of note, Lee, what's been your wisest investment decision to date?
My wisest investment decision.
Obviously, we have to exclude Investment Quorum being the fantastic business it is.
Well, we'll see. Yeah, we're way through that. We'll see. But my wisest one, I guess, was an investment in a brewery through an EIS, which did incredibly well in an enterprise investment scheme. That did very, very well. But that was really just through a discussion with some friends who were also doing it. The wisest overall investment decision, I guess, is just be in it for the long term. It's almost the same answer to the last question.
Okay.
You know, we can all point to wins we've had with shares or funds, and you look at just how some stocks have performed within portfolios. Apple been brilliant for me.
Yeah.
You know, because I went in quite a while ago. I thought it's interesting the way the press now pick on Apple a bit about innovation, but hey. I guess that's the press, maybe. But
yeah,
I think it is all about getting a market, staying in the markets. Try not to time them. Try not to read. And I say this as someone who appears in them quite frequently.
Yeah.
Try not to read too many of the Sunday financial pages too deeply. you know, they have copy. They have pages to sell. They have copy to sell. So just stick to your plan. Have faith in your ability. Do your research. Get professional advice if you don't feel so confident. Or you want to do it in conjunction with someone. So I guess that's the answer.
Thank you very much for that. Now, Lee, if there's one thing you could change regarding the investing landscape, what would it be? You're in control now. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah. It's an all-encompassing answer, I guess. The first thing would be charges. I think in the UK, it is still too expensive to invest. I think the passive funds, if we talk about funds for a second, they have thrown the gauntlet down on costs and charges. The regulator did a bit of work through the retail distribution review a few years ago about charges and costs, but I think it's still too expensive. Now, whether, talking of technology again, whether blockchain helps with that and it starts to take out some of the players in the chain that add up all the costs, I hope so. So If I could, that would be it. And I also think the cost disclosure needs to be better. The regulator's just done a piece on it. We were involved in it, having to submit evidence. We need to be able to explain to the public, the investor, just what they're paying for, what the value it is, and why they're paying it. And I still think it's too expensive. So if I had the magic wand, the proverbial magic wand, I would probably get fees reduced wherever I could.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Now, Lee, obviously, as you know, I'm big on the learning curve, hence, you know, doing Conker's Corner. Uh-huh. Now, I of note is the fact that obviously you went into the Navy as a young man, and you didn't go on to university, but you went on more recently to do a degree a few years back. Yeah.
Yeah, I did.
So what was that degree in, and what was the calling for you to go back and do it?
I think it was unfinished business for me. You know, I'm from a working class family in Scotland, originally farming stock. And we were that first generation, I guess, that were destined to go to university. But I was a kind of restless young man, you know, as far as that goes. So
yeah.
I sometimes think boys do education at the wrong stage of their life because they were just to do lally back then.
I completely agree with that. Yeah.
So I guess it was unfinished business. I was certainly bright enough to go to university, but I fluffed the O's and all that kind of stuff. So just because I was, you know, a bit of a harum scarum idiot, really. So I joined the armed forces, enjoyed that. That straightened me out. And then a bit later on, I decided that it would be good to do a degree. And I did it rather boringly, perhaps. I did it in financial services at Edinburgh Napier as a distance learning student and enjoyed it to a degree. But I think when I go on to do my master's, which I've decided I want to do, I'm going to do it in something like history, which I really enjoy, as opposed to something vocational.
Yeah. Okay. That's excellent, mate. Because the learning element of Conker's Corner is about educating people and about it. It's never too late, and it's the importance of continual learning, which is what you have to do in your industry anyway, you know. But you going and taking the time out to do the degree, I think that's brilliant.
Well, I think as a business owner, you carry a huge responsibility first and foremost to your clients, then to all your staff and colleagues. So I think it is right, whilst we have to do lots of technical training as a requirement of holding our license to operate individually, why wouldn't you do a bit more work on yourself? And you know, I also spend time at Judge Business School doing bits and pieces there on management, you know, because so many of us are self-taught. I didn't go through the big company management training program anywhere.
Yeah.
So in many ways, you make it up. I think in many ways that's good, because you react very quickly, and you work on what your own moral compass tells you to do, as opposed to what a shareholder requirement is or et cetera. But it's nice to be continually learning. And I found later on in life that I really enjoy it. I mean, I using tech again, as we're talking about tech, I subscribe to Skillshare. It's just full of courses about this, that, and the other that you watch on video. Everything from photography, which I really enjoy, through to cooking or drawing or business writing. There's just thousands of them, and it's a nice way to while away an hour watching a video, learning a skill.
Yeah.
It's a big benefit, I think, of what the regulator did. Our regulator comes in for quite a bit of criticism from time to time, from all corners, from the government, from the public, from the industry. But one of the things that I think they did really well was they brought us to the table, and certainly the unwilling ones, I'm not saying I was, and they had to get on, they had to keep their technical training up, because they're out talking to the public about quite technical matters, and often their knowledge was nowhere near as good as it should be. So I think the regulator has instilled in so many of us this lifelong learning. And I know peers in my sector now who are going on to do doctorates in financial services related things. And that's got to be good for the long-term future for the investing public.
Well, I've got to agree with that. You know, I mean, there's a great quote. You know, I always like to throw a quote in one of my Conker's Corner interviews, but it comes from Albert Einstein regarding education. Education is not the learning of facts, but the training of the mind to think. Do you remember that one?
I think I do, and I think it's brilliant. I mean, the guy was brilliant, of course, but I think that encapsulates absolutely everything. You know, I hear there's discussion about, you know, kids nowadays doing degrees and are they worth doing degrees and things? And I think they are, because it gets you into that way of thinking that you don't have as a child, but you do as a man or a woman. You know, you have to go on and bring critical thinking to issues, whether it's research on shares, whether it's running a company, whether it's whatever you happen to be involved in. And I think education is just a cornerstone. And I think being a Scot, the Scottish education system was incredibly strong when I was young. I'm not sure I made the best use of it back then, but I hope it continues. I hope, you know, the UK education system continues. Looking from the outside in, the teachers always seem to be fighting with the government and all this kind of stuff, but somewhere at the heart of it, we've got to prepare young people for an incredibly fast changing world, and education's got to be such a cornerstone of that.
Absolutely. I mean, there's lots of research going in now and lots of people promoting STEM, you know, so all the younger people getting involved into technology across all different sectors, and especially young women getting into financial services and business and, you know, all the technology sectors as well. So it's not just boys and, you know, young men.
No, definitely. And talking earlier about the Civic City, I'm involved with a very new guild called the Guild of Entrepreneurs. And what's interesting with that is, unlike many of the older, more established companies and worshipful companies, the guild is young and it has a very diverse membership. It's about 50-50 women and men. And it's just brilliant to be sitting next to a woman running a video production company. I was talking to a young woman the other day, and she's taking on some of the biggest cosmetic brands with her website, and she's doing it incredibly successfully. So I think it's right. I think we should have more women engineers, more women builders, more women software engineers. I mean, I don't want to sound like some old fuddy-duddy man, but I think they bring a fair. I mean, it's brilliant having a business partner like Petronella. She brings a completely different mindset sometimes to the way I look at problems. I'm quite male. I'm quite linear in my thinking. I work by gut. She works very different. She brings more emotion to it. And I think with a private client business and with investing, sometimes you need a bit of emotion.
Absolutely. And I think, as you say, and research has proven it, is that the more diverse the team, the more productive they are, long term anyway, you know. And what's happened with some of the legacy companies, and I mean, prime example was, is probably Marks and Spencer's, and its decline over the years has been because of the team that they had in place, which was all very linear, you know, unfortunately, and all male. And more so recently, they've changed some of that, but it's almost appearing like it's a little bit too late.
Yeah. It seems to me that a particular company like Marks and Spencer's, which sells a huge amount of its product to women, should have a much better representation at
Absolutely.
Board level of women. It just it seems like common sense to you and I, but of course, big business doesn't always think that way.
They don't, unfortunately. Now, Lee, as you know, and you've listened to the Petronella interview, I love my books because I think it's important, and we're talking about learning now and people educating themselves. Now, regarding the investment field and wealth management, etc., are there any books that you are absolutely like, oh, when I read that book, I learned so much from it, and I recommend it to clients or to colleagues and friends? Are there any books out there that you're really, really big fan of?
Yeah, anything by Warren Buffett. You know, right. It's, and I guess probably just about everyone on your show says that, but anything by Warren Buffett, it is, you know, the Sage of Omaha. Mm-hmm. He has had a stellar career doing what he does, and there are so many good lessons about buying, holding, looking for dividends, doing your research properly. There are other ones. I think Dr. Daniel Crosby, if you want to get a little bit more cerebral, he talks a lot about behavioral investing, where people often shoot themselves in the foot. They sabotage themselves by the way they jump in and out of markets and the way they have biases to certain things. So that's, I like his stuff too. They would definitely be standouts for me.
Yeah, I mean, I interviewed Daniel recently, and his book is absolutely phenomenal. He's a really down-to-earth chap as well. He's had a fantastic journey. So I would also recommend Daniel's book, of course.
Yeah, so there's another one just come to mind, Andrew Craig, who I know. He's got a book which is riding really high on the Amazon list. It's called How to Own the World.
Oh,
and I can probably get you a signed copy. I know where he is.
If you'd be so kind, thank you.
No, he you know, used to be in investment banking, and he's written a really common sense book of how to, where to, what not to do, et cetera, et cetera. He's not entirely fulsome in praise of professionals either, which I think is a good thing. You know, we need to be challenged. Our smugness needs to be challenged. So I would recommend it. It's incredibly readable. It's How to Own the World by Andrew Craig. It's on Amazon. It's, I don't know, 20 quid or something. I think it's a well worth 20 quid.
Okay, thank you ever so much. Thank you for those recommendations. I appreciate that. Now, I've got one last question. If there's anything else you want to add at the end, I'd really appreciate that. Uh-huh. If you were starting out today in investing, Lee, what would you do that you had not considered or you were unable to do back in the 90s?
I would make far more effort to pay regularly. I think the powers of compound interest and pound cost averaging are just phenomenal. I think it was Einstein
yep.
who said it was what, the eighth wonder of the world or something.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And I think that's absolutely right. You know, very early on, it's too easy to live up to your expectation of your lifestyle. So work really hard. I say this particularly to younger clients and children of clients. Work out what your outgoings are. Work out what your income is, and always find a slice to put away monthly, and you'd be amazed over the years how that builds up. So I think I wish I'd done more of that when I was younger, as opposed to ad hoc bits here and there when I could. I know it's tough, you know, we'll have mortgages to pay and rent to pay.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And I think when we got our first mortgage, I think we got it at 12%. It went up to 16% and nearly crippled us. But you get through that kind of stuff. Mm. But it wasn't all plain sailing back then, which is what I was saying to a younger client the other day who said, you guys all had it so easy. Wasn't 16% interest rates weren't that easy, let me tell you.
Yeah.
But I think that's the thing. Definitely. Start early. Be regular and just keep doing it, and you'd just be amazed how it builds up over the years.
Absolutely. I mean, the full Albert Einstein quote is, compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. He who understands it earns it. He who doesn't pays it.
Yeah, I think that's just sums it up. You know, he was a pithy man, as you say in Scotland. He's very pithy. Yeah. So that's my big tip, and I wish I'd done more of it.
Okay, Lee, I've covered all my questions. Thank you ever so much for sharing your investment insights and knowledge with Conquest Corner. I didn't know if there's anything you wanted to round off and encapsulate your journey with, you know, thus far with me.
No, first I'd like to say thank you for the opportunity for coming on board. From my side, to finish by wishing anyone who's listening and investing the best success with their endeavors. It's a fascinating world, but it's an incredibly crucial world, because we're all building wealth for our future lives. And so I wish everyone absolute luck and good fortune.
Thank you ever so much, Lee. You're a wonderful chap, very humble considering your vast achievements over the last 20 odd years. And I wish you very good fortune going forward, you, Petronella, and the team at Investment Quorum.
Thank you very much.
All right. Speak soon, Lee. Take care. God bless.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, chap.